Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 116, recorded August 21st, 2013. Philip Rosedale. Triangulation is brought to you by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription sourcing their beans directly from the growers. They're roasted and shipped within 24 hours, giving you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/triangulation. That's T-O-N-X.org. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we meet and greet and talk to the most interesting, smartest people on the internet. And boy, have we got a great one for you. I say this every week, but it's true every week. Philip Rosedale is here. You may remember Philip's name from Linden Labs, which he started in around 1996. Linden Labs, you may remember, is the creators of Second Life, the 3D world that was all the rage. I remember they were talking about companies opening headquarters in Second Life, embassies, countries had embassies in Second Life. Philip is joining us now to talk about something new he's working on, among other things. Philip, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now, are you still associated in any way with Second Life?
Well, I'm not, but Second Life is one of the investors in High Fidelity, the new company. So we're definitely friendly and working together.
And Second Life continues on, does it not?
It sure does.
Yeah.
Second Life is about as big today as it was at its peak, actually. It just has not grown in users over the years. And, of course, the media attention around it, went away after a while.
It's so, as somebody in the media, I apologize. But we have the shortest attention span ever. And if something isn't, if nobody's opening an embassy in it, then we don't have a story. And so we move on. But obviously, people still are very interested in Second Life. But let's go back. Let's go before Second Life.
Sure.
Because you actually started your first company in high school.
I sure did. Yeah.
That's so are you – I know you're a geek and a physicist and a programmer, but would you say business was your first interest?
Well, I think I was always entrepreneurial. Growing up, I always wanted to have a little extra money, and so – if I could turn things that were going on in my head or projects I was working on into money in some sense, I was certainly interested in that. First and foremost, though, I was a computer programmer. That first company was doing database software programming and hooking up PCs together in a network, which this was before the days of the internet. So, I was hooking up BNC cables between PCs using Novell's NetWare.
Oh, man. Yeah, NetWare.
Way before the internet.
This and 10 base T, thin copper. Yeah. Wow.
And it worked. And so I was doing business database kind of work, which was just, something that, I had seen a couple of companies doing different things and was able to write software to help them do what they did better and get a few customers and wear a pager, so they could page me when things went wrong. And, it worked out great.
According to Wikipedia, they paid your way through college,
it did. It sure did.
That
I was studying physics in college.
Yeah.
It was great.
That's an interesting choice for somebody who's a programmer. Why not computer science?
Well, by the time I entered college, I felt like I was pretty into computer programming. I picked it up pretty young. So I was probably a bit cocky and thought that, kind of knew what I wanted to do with computers.
Yeah.
But physics had always fascinated me since I was a kid. Like the way the world worked and the mechanism of things and molecules and space and all that was just so fascinating that I thought it was a bigger challenge to study in school. And I guess something that would help me kind of more generally do the things with computers that I thought would be really cool.
Yeah, because physics actually, by then even, was very computationally intensive. It was all about computers.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting work going on. You're right. Even then, I was in college from 86 to 92, and there was a lot of computing happening.
So tell me how the idea for Second Life came about. Was that the original plan at Linden Labs?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, you can ask Rob Glazer at Real Networks, and he'll tell you I was the CTO there in in 99.
They had acquired your company, ProView.
They sure had, yeah. I'd been there from 96 to 99, and everybody at Real Networks can tell you that I was just absolutely nuts about this idea of building a virtual world, and I couldn't do it. I didn't feel I could do it sort of pre-broadband. And in 1999 at Real Networks, we could see that broadband was going to make it as the way you connected to the internet. And also, NVIDIA had released this one little chip called the GeForce 2 was shipping in all the Dell computers, you know, to consumers. And I got one of those computers and stuck it at home in Seattle, which was Seattle at the time, and started doing a little 3D on it. And I went back to Rob and the gang at Real and I said, I got to go, you guys. I got to go work on this crazy idea. So Second Life, it was something that I'd always wanted to do. I'd always wanted to build, use the internet. When I first saw the internet, I thought the thing to do with this is to connect a whole lot of computers together to create a big shared space that people can build anything in. And that idea was just, I don't know, so mind-bogglingly cool to me that I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so in 99, when those two changes happened, I took off from Real, with everybody's blessing and came back here to San Francisco and found this little tiny, crazy, really rough condition warehouse in Hayes Valley on Linden and started the company.
That's cool. So the challenges of doing something like this are huge. I mean, you mentioned the graphics processor, but also network latency is a huge issue.
It's a really big challenge. And, you know, part of the reason why I'm working on high fidelity now is that network latency, you're absolutely right, has dropped so much. Even while we've had broadband, network latency has gone from, you know, that the time of flight for a packet from San Francisco to New York has gone from maybe 250 milliseconds or so on average back when Second Life was just being built, to something like 40 milliseconds today. It's about 40 milliseconds to get a packet from here to New York. And 40 milliseconds, as it relates to the brain and to human experience, is a really different and small amount of time. We can't see, in most cases, 40 milliseconds go by.
So if you're in a virtual world and you're moving around and there's a second lag between your action and the changing screen, that's horrible. But if it's 40 milliseconds, it's doable.
It's pretty good. Like if you look at your cell phones today, you're not going to believe this, but we've tested it. We do it with oscilloscopes here in our lab in high fidelity. Most of our cell phone connections today are about 400 to 500 milliseconds of delay, about a half a second.
Wow.
And that is what causes us to talk on top of each other. Like, in fact, right now we're using Skype.
I stepped on you. Yeah.
to do this interview. And you can see we have to be, both of us, who have done this stuff before, are comfortable and trying hard not to step on each other. But it's difficult. And that's because Skype actually tends to be a little better than a cell phone, but it's still on the order of maybe 350 milliseconds or something. Kind of watching myself on your screen right now and estimating in my mind.
Yeah, it's noticeable. Yeah, you can count it. Yeah.
Yeah. So at 40, I'll tell you something. When somebody talks, like if I'm talking right now and you're sitting and listening to me, your head is nodding up and down with these little nodding motions. And those motions have been studied for the last 20 years or so. I can see you doing it right now. And when you're out of sync with me, though, it's hard because I'm watching that nodding to understand whether you're interested and think I'm full of baloney with what I'm saying. And if we can't do that, kind of almost dance together in that synchronization, it doesn't feel like being there. And so one of the things we're thinking as we work on high fidelity is, well, maybe if we can get down to 40 milliseconds and if we can do all the software around that correctly, maybe we can get that feeling closer to what it's like to sit across the table from somebody. And you can do that in a virtual world. That would be amazing.
This reminds me so much of the metaverse from Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. The idea that you would go into a virtual world that is as vivid and real as the real world, and you'd have a life in there, you'd have friends, you'd have a job, but it isn't the real world. It's a metaverse. Were you inspired by that? Was that part of what?
I sure was. I had been thinking about this idea, as I said, of kind of creating a big digital canvas or a big space that people could work in. I've been thinking about that for a long time. And when Snow Crash came out, and when I read it, it was delightful to see one very smart guy who was himself a developer prior to writing it, to see his take on what the metaverse could be.
So there's also the issue of the uncanny valley, which is much more difficult to solve. Certainly in real time, well, I might say impossible, but I'm sure in time that we'll solve it. But that is you talked about the 40-second, millisecond delay and how that gives us a real experience of looking at somebody. But the problem is we're looking at virtual avatars, and our mind is so smart and cleverly tuned to what is real and what is abnormal that it's almost impossible for a computer to generate a hand that doesn't give us kind of a queasy feeling. It's called the uncanny valley, the distance between reality and the best the computer can do.
You're hitting all the big questions. So the uncanny valley, exactly. If you watch my lips, you know, you watch my mouth move as I talk, the demand that we have that look exactly real. And in fact, exactly like the many millions of memories we have of watching lips move and hearing things before. You have to hit that straight on. And where our brain pays the most attention is where things seem the most, as you say, uncanny when they're not right.
Right.
You know, virtual worlds have tackled this in a variety of different ways. And I think that we've got to find a happy medium where we're not being too real and causing us all to get that queasy feeling of it's not a real person. And we're also being real enough that we can be expressive in the environment. And, you know, look at Toy Story, you know, that's exactly what Pixar did so masterfully when they took the level of computer-generated rendering they had at the time and applied it not to people's faces, which would have been creepy looking, but instead to these monsters. And that's the same sort of thing that I think we've got to now, as we now enter into this era where the latency and the computation is powerful enough to do something really amazing incrementally in virtual worlds, we've got to choose avatars and ways of rigging or controlling them that is amazing. You know, we're working a lot on that as well at High Fidelity, doing things, for example, like moving your head around in exactly the way it's really moving, but not moving your lips around. For example, if you do that, it doesn't seem uncanny.
Ah, how interesting. Yep. A lot of this is, as it's obvious you're doing, psychological research as to what the mind can understand and what it can't understand.
Absolutely.
How about Oculus Rift? Have you looked at something like that? I mean, you know, the metaverse you jacked in into a plug in the back of your head.
You can't quite do that yet. the Oculus is the closest thing to that we've got right now, though. You know, I had the biggest smile on my face. I think we had a picture of it somewhere when I put that thing on.
I bet.
We've got the Oculus connected to High Fidelity, to our new environment. And when we do demos, we sometimes do little get-togethers where we'll get a few people together, some of our friends, and show them what we're working on just to get useful feedback. You know, the Oculus is always the thing that's just mind-blowing. You know, there's all kinds of problems to be solved with an interface experience like the Oculus, though. Like, you know, you can't stand up and, you know, trip over your chair, and you also can't put the biggest one is you can't put your hands down on your keyboard because you can't see where the keyboard is when you're wearing this thing. And, you know, registering an imaginary keyboard in front of you, that doesn't work yet. So there's a lot of little things like that that will affect that experience. But what's definitely true is that, you know, getting the look of the experience pretty close to what it can really look like to be standing in a virtual world just makes a huge kind of an emotional difference in the experience.
For all these problems we've talked about, though, Second Life has been phenomenally successful. And I remember the experience of it for me was just mind-boggling. And you really want to spend time in there. You do make friends in there. You build things. People make money in there. There's a currency. And I'm really interested to hear that it continues on. What is it? How many people at a time are in there?
You know, there's typically 75 to 100,000 people that are in Second Life at one time, and it's this big, rich community that is as big as it's ever been. There is a big economy associated with it. When you think about
somebody's making coffee in there.
I know. Yeah, you're sitting in our new office here. When you think about what can make a virtual world, I think, enormous in this next generation of technology beyond what we've been able to do, I think a lot of it is, as you say, it's an amazing experience, but it's still pretty difficult. And I think a lot of that difficulty yes. is due to the mouse and the keyboard
yes.
and not having had things like the Oculus, like the Leap motion device, you know, all these Ooh. Different devices that connect, all these devices that seek to make it a little bit easier and give you more degrees of freedom for moving, seeing and manipulating things in a 3D world. And again, that's part of why I'm working now on high fidelity again, because I think the interface technology has changed enough along with the latency dropping that we can really do something amazing.
All right. Well, I want to talk about it. The next generation of virtual worlds in just a second. Our guest is Philip Rosedale, who created Linden Labs, founded Second Life, and is now founding the successor to Second Life, I guess, in some ways. And I wonder how his old friends at Second Life feel about that, but we'll talk about that in just a second. First, I want to talk about the best coffee you've ever had, and Tonks is it. And I tell you what, if you are interested in coffee, I drink a lot of it. And if you want to know more about coffee, treat coffee like the experience that it is, like a great wine or a great meal. Then you've got to know about Tonks, TONX.org. These are coffee connoisseurs who said, we want to give people a better experience. We want them to understand what it is they're drinking instead of just supermarket beans. You don't know how old they are. So what they do is they follow the sun around the world to go to coffee farms, single farm, single source. And of course, because it's around the world, because different seasons, you have to go around the world. And then they find the best. They bring them right to their roastery in Southern California. They roast them, and within 24 hours, ship them out to you. You're going to get your Tonks coffee every other week, fresh. Fresh roasted, fresh beans. It makes an amazing coffee, but because it's also single farm, you get different flavors. You get different overtures. It's overtones. It's an amazing experience. And I think if you're interested in knowing more about coffee or you know somebody who loves coffee, you've got to know about Tonks. We have a special offer for you, a free sample. Cost you nothing. Visit tonx.org/triangulation. All you have to do is give them, create an account and claim your free trial. They'll mail it out to you. I get it every other week, and I have to say I look forward to it. The beans I'm drinking right now are from Kenya, but I just got some from Guatemala, Ecuador, all over the world. And everyone has a different characteristic. It's kind of interesting. I didn't know there was such variety. They recommend that you grind it yourself fresh right before you make the cup. I use an AeroPress. You could use a Chemex or a drip. And you get an amazing cup of coffee. So I invite you to try it right now. TONX.org/triangulation. It would be a very nice gift for the coffee geek or future coffee geek in your life. Tonks.org. We're talking to Philip Rosedale of High Fidelity. Now, it was Coffee and Power. That was your company, right? And then you shifted into something else.
That's right. That's right. Most of us who were working on Coffee and Power actually came over onto High Fidelity. And
was this your stealth plan?
We were always thinking. I've always been. I'm. You know, my life's work, I think, will be virtual worlds. I love the subject, and I think that they can be, 100 or 1,000 times bigger than they are today. So I'm going to keep working on it. So, yes, I had constantly been watching the changes in technology, as I said, and wondering when would be the right time to try and, to start all over again with as big a vision as Second Life and try to do it all with new technology.
Were you under a non-compete? I mean, could you not do this for a certain period of time or?
Some of the investors in High Fidelity are the same investors in Second Life. As I said, Second Life itself is one of those investors. So we've got a very friendly relationship.
Okay.
What we're working on at High Fidelity here is some really big ideas that are markedly farther out than, you know, building something that's, you know, like differentially a competitor with Second Life. So our hope is actually that, you know, if we're doing sort of laboratory research right now in things like latency, like we were talking about earlier, there may actually be ways that we can actually help Linden Lab and Second Life with Second Life while still planning something that is really quite a bit farther out in terms of strategy. I like big projects and, you know, big ideas, and this is no exception.
Well, I think you get an idea if you go to highfidelity.io, the website, yeah. And the tagline is, if it doesn't hurt to think about it, we're not going to try it. It's this is a moonshot. You're not talking about, oh, let's just build a little product here.
Yeah, and there's our little crazy first circuit board that we
that's cool.
Glued onto a pair of glasses there. And that was one of the things that got us started. We put that on some glasses. We later did a demo with the Google Glass that was shown at Google I.O. Pretty fun, where we're basically able to capture that rotation of your head and carry it exactly with no latency into the avatar. It's a really interesting experience that you have to see to believe. And it was one of the things that got us here sitting around the table working on Cognitive Empire. I put this pair of glasses on and we had this, you know, little funny Bert and Ernie kind of avatar on the screen, and we all looked over my shoulder, and while I moved my head back and forth, and we all said, oh, that's really important.
That's so is the goal here to create a metaverse, to create an experience that's indistinguishable from the real world?
Well, I think I think that we'll always have something that's different. I mean, I think aspirationally, we as human beings kind of create the world around ourselves, don't we?
And you can't fly in the real world, but you can fly in Second
Life. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things that there are things we can do better in a virtual world. Like, you know, if I'm having a meeting and everybody's kind of looking at me, which is something that is really important to a group of people when we're sitting and meeting in the real world, you know, the fact that they're all looking at me is something that we can make more visible, for example. Or I could look across the room and whisper and talk to somebody in the virtual world and they could hear me, you know. I could, you know, the computer could interpret what I'm doing and narrowly kind of define my focus on that one person and bring the audio up and make it absolutely perfect. There's a ton of things we can do in the virtual world that we just can't do in the real world. Yeah. And so I think different in some ways better, certainly in some ways worse. The real world has tremendous sort of fidelity, I guess, to coin a expression from our own name. And we'll probably strive forever to surpass that. But I can tell you that I definitely believe that a lot of human energy and commerce and intuition and a lot of innovation and prototyping is going to happen in the virtual world. I think a lot of our meetings are going to happen in the virtual world. I don't think I'm too crazy a thinker to suggest such.
No, not at all.
Starting to do it now.
It's just
getting it all working right.
Well, and there's different, you know, I've had since 1992 an internet relay chat going on whenever I'm on the air. And that's a virtual world. It's not Absolutely. It's just text, and it is to a virtual world what Infocom Adventures are to Call of Duty. However, you can do a lot with it.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. Your background in physics is very interesting too, because I would guess that that's informing a little bit of what you're doing. Your bio says you're interested in cellular automata. And there's a great video demo on your website, the flocking demo. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, that particle. Boy, that's funny. I'm just watching it now on your screen. I'm pretty embarrassed. That's a terrible little video capture. But that was another.
I don't know any better. It looks great to me.
You know, there are so many phenomena in nature that can be captured or simulated on computers that are just unbelievably cool, that simply rely on the fact that we have a lot of computing power to make them happen. And fluids and those particles moving around are sort of particles that are sort of, they're kind of moving around in a wind and affecting each other in a sort of a novel way that we devised that creates a lot of complexity without demanding too much of the computer. There are a bunch of ideas like these that we're going to bring together into this new work we're doing. And yeah, I mean, I think it's going to allow us to have a kind of an organic experience in these upcoming virtual worlds in high fidelity that are going to be mind-blowing, you know, that are going to really feel good to us as people. You know, we're humans. We've lived in a world surrounded by all these wonderful sensory experiences, and it's amazing to realize that so many of them, with sufficient computing power, can be redone in the virtual world.
I think what's interesting is how all of a sudden all of these technologies are converging on this point and making more possible than ever before. And of course, it's very technology bound. You know, I mean, it's good you're doing the psychological research and so forth. But really, it's all technology. I'm looking at the Google Glass demo, which is really fun.
Isn't that great?
Yeah,
that's my co-founder Ryan wearing the glass, and I mean it's just those are actually a little slower too than what you know, if you come to our offices here we can show you, but it's amazing to see that movement happen with very little delay, where it really is a matter of milliseconds, you know, 10 milliseconds or so in those cases, where we're moving that head to follow your head. When your brain sees that, there are neurons that light up. Many people have read about this thing called mirror neurons, which are the neurons that kind of light up when you see something that you're sort of projecting an activity back onto yourself. And those types of phenomena are really important, I think, for making us feel good as we enter into these virtual worlds. But as you said, it is all technology. When you look at all this amazing technology that's come out in the last couple of years, at least when I look at it, you just say, wow, you know, how much are we going to be able to do when we figure out how to use all this amazing equipment that's coming out? You look at the Oculus and you think, we don't even know yet how to what to do with that, you know, and so I think as we bring all this stuff together in real working products, it's going to be staggering.
Are you seeing this as as something for fun, recreation, or for business, or what would you like High Fidelity to be?
I'd say it's too early to tell. You know, like we did with Second Life, we're going to focus on building kind of taking advantage of technology and building the experience to be as amazing as possible, and then stepping back and looking at it and saying, well, what can we do with this? You know, with Second Life, we didn't try to be very prescriptive at all. Part of the success of Second Life, and I think it's huge success, was that we didn't really try to over-inform or suggest what everybody should do.
It was free for all. Yeah.
Yep. I think that's going to be true here. In fact, I suspect even more so, just in the sense that the technology is becoming more functional and more generalized. When I even look back at Second Life, there's so many amazing things happening there that are just going to happen sort of even more in parallel with each other once the basic, you know, degrees of freedom and latency and all these things get broken through.
I just want you to do it before I'm in the nursing home, because I would love to put that helmet on and then just have fun.
You know, as an entrepreneur for some years now, I sort of feel the same way. I got to on this. We got to all get this stuff working now.
Get going, dude.
Before we're too old to use it.
The clock is ticking.
Absolutely.
What are the biggest challenges? We talked about latency, the uncanny valley. What other challenges are you? This right now feels more like an R&D project than anything that's close to a product. Is that right?
Yes, and that's why we haven't launched or announced really anything about it. We're still looking for and building an amazing team of developers to help us work on it. When you talk about challenges, just building the software that coordinates all of the streaming, compression, storage, interaction of the software, just as it was with Second Life, is a tremendous challenge. So there's a lot of software work to be done. Second Life was a huge software project. We were about 4 years working on it prior to its launch.
Wow.
I would say that, you know, this is as great an undertaking. Certainly the tools have improved of the trades, so we can build software today faster than ever. But it's still a really big project. And so right now we're kind of in that R&D phase, and we're in the phase where we're finding the core team of people that really love this stuff and, you know, really have great intuitions about it and are fantastic to join us. So we're just playing with ideas, and it is very much a lab. If you came in our office right now, it's just wonderful. You know, we got, you know, it's a garage sale of different pieces of equipment and experiments and little features we're playing with. A lot of fun.
It's probably off topic, but I'm intrigued by the cellular automata side of it. You know, a lot of us read Martin Gardner. You're too young, but I read Martin Gardner's column in Scientific American about life, and he talked about it a lot and the game
of
life.
Funny. I'm not too young. That article, that one article with, I think we're both talking about the same one, which was the article where it was describing the actual game of life. That was what got me partly into computer programming. I literally implemented that in assembly language.
Oh, wow.
I wanted to see Stephen Wolfram's little one-dimensional automata. Gardner had a segment about how to implement the sort of 1D little waterfall automata. And I wrote it in, I think, BASIC or something, and it was too slow. And so I was, I think I was in seventh or eighth grade at the time, and I figured out how to make it run faster by kind of breaking into the assembler on the Apple II. And that was my first experience doing that type of programming. And I remember seeing it stream by on the screen, and I was so hooked at that point, looking at that, you know, looking at those amazing, unimaginable patterns appearing on the screen of my computer. I was just like, the whole universe is in here. You know, we can do anything in here. If we can do something like that, that kind of complexity can lead to a whole nother world. And really, for me, when I tell the story of Second Life and of my own passion about virtual worlds, I always talk about these early automata, and you hit it right on the nose.
That's cool.
Those Scientific American articles were exactly the ones that inspired me to.
So cool. And you wrote in assembly language, which is pretty impressive. Do you still play with it? I mean, there's a whole movement, you know, going on trying to go to the next level. I used to have Breve or Breve Walker. I used to have a thing that would teach itself to walk over time. Yep. And
those are fantastic.
I love those.
We are actually in a practical sense, and it's really interesting. And, you know, again, you know, we're trying to find people to help us with this. We are literally looking at how those kind of automata and evolutionary algorithms and those types of approaches, physics simulation, can be used as implicitly part of this new virtual world. Our feeling is that if we could create a virtual world that has emergent properties that come from really basic rules of how the little atoms, to use the right term, really, of the virtual world interact with each other, we should be able to strike a balance between something that has this chaotic emergent properties and is also something that you could build amazing things with. And that is exactly a piece of the scientific research work that we're doing right now. Absolutely.
No kidding. So it isn't just a toy. There is it's applicable to what you're up to.
Yep, absolutely.
Wow. So might we go into high fidelity at some point and not only run into real people, but non-player entities that are actually computer beings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously another great big question right now, and one that...
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. It's really chilling. And exciting. And, you know, you have to wonder, too, that if we do build AI, if we do use simulation and automata and neural networks and, you know, all the different wonderful things that are being played around with right now, if we are able to create interesting types of new organisms or, you know, creatures or whatever that you might run into, the question can be asked, which is, are they going to grow up in virtual worlds, or are they going to grow up as little, you know, robots that interact with us in the real world? And I tell you, it's interesting to consider that I think virtual worlds are a lot more likely, you know, as the home base, because virtual worlds are full of people. You know, look at Second Life. You know, there's a whole city worth of people there to talk to from all over the world at any moment, day or night. And so I think that... it's a lot more likely that we'll see whatever kind of life forms come of all this new computing power emerging inside virtual worlds, more likely than seeing them emerge in the real world. And so, yeah, I do think about that. I mean, it's a kind of a sci-fi edge of what we're doing, but it's definitely part of what makes it exciting and fascinating as we roll a few years further down the road.
Well, wouldn't it be interesting if down the road... this metaverse evolves into something. Well, I think of the deep philosophical implications of the Matrix, and the point that at some point a virtual world might be seen as the real world. And in fact, some say that that's exactly what's going on right now.
Yeah,
you might be doing some very heavy stuff here.
Yeah.
I love it. Do you consider that? I mean, is that of interest to you?
I think all of this stuff is what makes it fun to work on these things. I think for myself and for my co-founders and my team here, we like the big aspect of this problem and opportunity. You know, that's what inspires us and keeps us working hard on this day to day.
Yeah.
But I think the practical concerns are those of building the data compression and the, you know, getting together a big cloud of servers, which is another big part of our strategy here and how we do that. And those are the, you know, that's the kind of blocking and tackling we have to do to build something amazing. But it does definitely continue to beg all these fascinating questions. And in fact, I think, you know, when Second Life enjoyed an amount of media, which frankly, I don't know how many companies and products in history have ever enjoyed, you know, the amount of media. I remember in 2006, when Second Life was really best known, we were seeing something like 500 or 600 news articles a day written about it. And friends would call me and say, "Oh my gosh, did you read the such and such article?" And I'd say, "You know what? You're not going to believe this, but I actually don't, as a human, as a single person, have the capacity to read all this stuff." And I think the reason why that happened wasn't so much because we were such a remarkable company. It was because the issue is such a big one. I mean, you start talking about, hey, are we all going to live in a virtual world? And I think everybody kind of, you know, their eyes get a little bigger and they say, okay, you have my attention. You know, what are you guys doing and what do you think is going to happen? And I mean, what a fun thing to work on and what an important thing to work on and to do, hopefully do well.
Well, and I think the media's excitement was because this is almost science fiction. But also the potential is huge. I mean, people who are paraplegics who can't move can suddenly have a mobile, exciting virtual life that we can meet people from all over the world and interact with them and on and on and on. I think we've lost Philip's internet connection, unfortunately, but we have to run out. We're almost out of time anyway. We'll get him back and we'll say goodbye. If you want to find out more, you go to highfidelity.io. Read the blog because, I mean, this is early days yet. There's no product here and there won't be probably for some time. But if you read the blog, you'll see some of the really interesting stuff that they're doing. I wonder if they turned off the internet at his place. It seems
No, he said he's trying to call. I got a Skype chat from him.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll get them on. Somebody in the chat room did point out you can download the Game of Life and play with it. There are much more intriguing cellular automata out there now. It is a really fun area to kind of explore. I don't know if it's meaningful or a dead end. It's kind of hard to know, but
Hey, guys.
There we go. Welcome back. Yeah, that's the other person. We were talking about cellular automata, and you mentioned Stephen Wolfram. He's also very, and when he was on the show, we talked about it quite a bit. Very interesting.
Oh, you had him on. Great thinker in all these things.
I know you got to go, so we're going to let you go, but I'm so excited, Philip. I have a feeling we're a few years off before I can meet you in virtual reality and high fidelity, but I can't wait.
Well, we're already doing it. We're already doing it with video. I think it's not going to be long until we really can do it in a great way.
That's true. I mean, in a way, we are doing that, aren't we?
You couldn't have done this 5 years ago. You wouldn't have contemplated having a great, you know, really seriously produced show like you're doing and just calling me on Skype.
I've built a whole network based in Petaluma based on the fact that we can talk to anybody anywhere pretty much as if they were right here.
So true.
I can't give you a cup of Tonks coffee, but I wish I could. Thank you, Philip Rosedale. Thanks for Second Life, because that was a wonderful, wonderful endeavor that really, I think, opened people's eyes to what's possible. And I just can't wait to see what you do with modern technology to make this.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for having me
on. All right, take care. Philip Rosedale, highfidelity.io. We do triangulation every Wednesday afternoon right after this week in Google, right about 3:30 Pacific, 6:30 Eastern time. That's 22:30 UTC. If you want to join us live, we love it if you tune in. The chat room is a great way to interact. Even though you can't touch me, you can, or even hold hands, you can at least share ideas with us and questions, too, for our guests. But if you can't watch live, we do make on-demand audio and video available after the fact, always at our website, twit.tv/TRI, or subscribe. That way you'll get each episode every week. It was Esther Dyson last week. Who's next week, Carson? Do we know yet? Oh, Minyard Fogarty, Grammar Girl, is going to join us. She's got a new book. She's a great person. You've probably heard her podcast. It's just so much fun to get together and and chat over a good cup of Tonks coffee. Triangulation. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.